Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on pillaging Iraq right after this. You know, once in a while, we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, who was the former editor of the New York Tribune. Here's what he said to the New York Press Association back on February the 26th, 1936. He said, quote, "There's no such thing as a free and independent press in America, unless it's in some country town. And there's not one of you who dares express an honest opinion because you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid $150 a week for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for doing similar things. Now, if I should permit my honest opinions to be printed in one issue of my paper, like Othello, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Our business, he said, is to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his race and his country for his daily bread. We are the tools of rich men behind the scenes. We are intellectual prostitutes." Unquote. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and this New World Order, men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers, the Bushes, the Bundys, the Carnegies, and the Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and to stop following after all of these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and to survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy and the New World Order, why don't you call and order my four-hour free compact disc package. It's educational, entertaining, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Naomi Klein wrote in Harper's Magazine in September of 2004. She said, "It was only after I had been in Baghdad for a month that I found what I was looking for. I had traveled to Iraq," she said, "a year after the war began, at the height of what should have been a construction boom. But after weeks of searching, I had not seen a single piece of heavy machinery apart from tanks and Humvees. Then I saw it. It was a construction crane. It was a big and yellow, and it was impressive. And when I caught a glimpse of it around a corner in a busy shopping district, I thought I was finally about to witness some of the reconstruction that I'd heard so much about. But as I got closer, I noticed that the crane was not actually rebuilding anything. Not one of the bombed-out government buildings that still lay in rubble all over the city of Baghdad, nor one of the many power lines that remained in twisted heaps, even as the heat of summer was starting to bear down upon us. No, the crane was hoisting a giant billboard to the top of a three-story building. It said, Sunbullah honey, 100% natural, made in Saudi Arabia. Now, seeing the sign, I couldn't help but think back about something that Senator John McCain had said back in October. McCain said, "Iraq is a huge pot of honey that is attracting a lot of flies." Now, the flies that John McCain was referring to were the Halliburtons and the Bechtels, as well as the venture capitalists who flocked into Iraq in the path cleared by the Bradley fighting vehicles and laser-guided bombs. The honey that drew them was not just no-bid contracts and Iraq's famed oil wealth, but the myriad investment opportunities by a country that had just been cracked open after decades of being sealed off, first by the nationalistic economic policies of Saddam Hussein and then by the asphyxiating United Nations sanctions. Looking at the honey billboard, I was also reminded of the most common explanation for what has gone wrong in Iraq, a complaint that has been echoed by everyone from John Kerry to Pat Buchanan. Iraq is mired in blood and deprivation because George W. Bush didn't have a post-war plan. The only problem with this theory is that it isn't true. The Bush administration did have a plan for what it would do after the war. Put simply, it was to lay out as much honey as possible and then sit back and wait for the flies. Now, the honey theory of Iraq reconstruction stems from the most cherished beliefs of the war's ideological architects, that greed is good, not good just for them and their friends, but good for humanity as a whole, and certainly good for the Iraqis. Greed creates profit, which creates growth, which creates jobs and products and services and everything else that anyone could possibly want or need. The role of good government, then, is to create the optimal conditions for corporations to pursue their bottomless greed so that they, in turn, can meet the needs of the society. The problem is that governments, even neoconservative governments, rarely get the chance to prove their sacred theory to be correct. Despite their enormous ideological advances, even George Bush's Republicans are, in their own minds, perennially sabotaged by meddling Democrats, intractable unions, and alarmist environmentalists. Iraq was going to change all of that. In one place on Earth, the theory would finally be put into practice in its most perfect and uncompromising form. A country of 27 million people would not be rebuilt as it was before the war. It would be erased. It would disappear. And in its place would spring forth a gleaming showroom for laissez-faire economics, a utopia such as the world has never seen before. Every policy that liberates multinational corporations to pursue their quest for profit would be put into place. A shrunken state, a flexible workforce, open borders, free trade, minimal taxes, no tariffs, and no ownership restrictions. The people of Iraq would, of course, have to endure some short-term pain. Assets privately owned by the state would have to be given up to create new opportunities for growth and investment. Jobs would have to be lost, and as foreign products flooded across the border with free trade, local businesses and family farms would unfortunately be unable to compete. But to the authors of this plan, these would be small prices to pay for the economic boom that would surely explode once the proper conditions were in place. A boom that would prove to be so powerful that the country would practically rebuild itself. The fact that the boom never came, and Iraq continues to tremble under explosions of a very different sort, should never be blamed on the absence of a plan. Rather, the blame rests with the plan itself and the extraordinary violent ideology upon which it was based. Now, William Grider in The Nation added to that by saying that the presidential pageant has now risen full in the sky and is blocking out the sun. Until November, we dwell in a weird half-light, stumbling into spooky shadows, but shielded from the harsh glare of the nation's actual circumstances. Down is up. Fiction is truth. Momentous realities are made to disappear from the public mind. The 2004 spectacle is not the first to mislead grossly and exploit emotional weaknesses in the national character. But this time, the consequences will be especially grim. The United States is losing the war in Iraq, literally losing territory and losing population to the other side. And careful readers of the leading newspapers may already know this, but I doubt that most of the voters do. How could they? Given the martial self-congratulations of the president and relative restraint from his opponent. High-minded pundits tell us not to dwell on the long-ago past, but the cruel irony of 2004 is that Vietnam is the story. The arrogance and the deceit and the utter waste of human life, ours and theirs, play out before us once again, day by day, on the evening news, and a frank discussion will have to wait until after the elections are over. Several weeks ago, an ominous article appeared in the opinion section of the New York Times. One by one, Iraqi cities have become no-go zones. Fallujah, Samarra, Ramadi, Karbala, and the sadder city slums of Baghdad. These and other population centers are now controlled by various insurgencies and essentially ceded by U.S. forces. And this situation would make a joke of the national elections planned for January unless something very dramatic changes. Yes, if the U.S. troops try to recapture these lost cities, the bombing and the urban fighting would produce massive killing and destruction, further poisoning politics for the United States and the United States occupation and its puppet government in Saigon. Oh, I'm sorry, the puppet government in Baghdad. 3 days later, the story hit page one when anonymous Pentagon officials confirmed the reality. Not to worry, they said. The United States is training and expanding the infant Iraqi army so that it can do the fighting for us. That's the ticket. Vietnamization. I remember how well General Westmoreland articulated this strategy back in the 1960s in Vietnam, when war's progress was measured by official body counts and reports on new fighting forces were on the way. But this time, Washington decided the United States could not wait for Iraqization, a strategy that might sound limp-wristed to American voters. The U.S. bombing and assaults quickly resumed, and the Bush White House is thus picking targets and second-guessing its field commanders, just as Lyndon Johnson did 40 years ago in Indochina. Bush is haunted by the mordant remark that a U.S. combat officer made in Vietnam. He said, "We had to destroy the village in order to save it." Meanwhile, Bush's war is destroying the United States Army, just as LBJ's war did in Vietnam. After Vietnam, military leaders and Richard Nixon wisely abolished the draft and opted for an all-volunteer force. When this war ends, and it inevitably will, the volunteer army will be in ruins, and a limited draft lottery may be required to fill out the ranks. After Iraq, men and women will get out of uniform in large numbers, especially as they grasp the futility of their sacrifice. Yet Bush, on the cheap, war-making against a weak opponent, demonstrates that a larger force structure is needed to sustain his policy of preemptive war. Kerry says that he wants 40,000 more troops, just in case. Old generals doubt that Congress would pay for it, given the defects in the plan. Iraq is Vietnam standing in the mirror. John Kerry, if he had it in him, could lead a national teach-in, a re-education of those who have forgotten or petrified their memories, but especially inform the youngsters of America who weren't around for the national shame of Vietnam a generation ago. Kerry could describe in plain English what's unfolding now in Iraq and what must be done to find a way out with honor. In other words, be a truth-teller while holding Bush accountable. But remember, they both belong to the same fraternity, Skull and Bones. Kerry won't go there, probably couldn't go there without enduring still greater anger. His war hero campaign biography inadvertently engendered slanderous attacks and still smoldering resentments. Kerry, like other establishment Democrats, originally calculated that the Democratic Party should be as pro-war as the Republicans and George Bush, thus freeing him to run on other issues. That was a gross miscalculation, and it left him proffering a very lame solution, persuading France, Germany, and the others to send their troops into this quagmire. Not bloody likely, as the Brits would say. Well, Bush can't go near the truth for obvious reasons, because if elected, he faces only more bad choices. Bomb the bejesus out of Iraq as Nixon bombed Vietnam and Cambodia, or bug out under the cover of artful lies. The one thing that Bush's famous resolve cannot achieve is success at war, never mind that he aims to win the election instead. So this presidential contest resembles a grotesque, media-focused war in which two sides skirmish for the attention of ill-informed voters. Bush won big back when he got off of Iraq and he got it off of the front pages and evening news with his phony handoff of sovereignty and his chest-thumping convention. But then his opponents, the hostile insurgents in Iraq, struck back, and brilliantly. And they managed to put the war story back in the lead on the news. Might we expect them, or from them, an October surprise of even deadlier proportions? In his fight, Kerry is like a bystander who might benefit from bad news but can't wish for it. Most combat correspondents, with brave exceptions, hesitate to stick back from the daily facts and tell the larger truth. Maybe they're afraid of sounding partial. The timing of events in Iraq does not fit propitiously with the election calendar. A majority has already concluded that it was a mistake to fight this war, but public credulity is not yet totally destroyed. A majority still wants to believe that the strategy may yet succeed and that Iraq won't become another dark stain in our history books. During Vietnam, the process of giving up on such wishful thinking took many years. The breaking point came in 1968 when a majority turned against the war, and LBJ withdrew from running for re-election. Nixon won that year, you'll remember, with his secret plan to win the peace. The war continued for another 5 years, and American casualties doubled under Nixon. This time, public opinion has moved much faster against the war, but perhaps not fast enough. People naturally are reluctant to conclude that their country did any wrong or any wrong thing, that young people died for a pointless and useless cause. And if the war story does not stay hot, or if the war story does stay hot and high on the front pages, a collapse of faith might occur in time for this election, but more likely it will come after the election. Nixon won a landslide re-election in 1972 with his election eve announcement that peace was at hand. The troops were coming home. In the hands of skilled manipulators, horrendous defeat can be turned into honorable victory, temporarily at least. When the enemy eventually triumphed in Indochina, Nixon was already gone, driven out for other crimes. Now, the National Guard deployments that are going over to Iraq should be mentioned. These National Guard deployments work like this. There were over 40 National Guard and Reserve soldiers killed in the months of June and July. This grim statistic underscores the concern about their safety and combat qualifications. 40,000 National Guard and Reserve members are currently deployed in Iraq. That's about one-fourth of the 160,000 National Guard and Reserve units on active duty. Now, why is it that states such as South Dakota, Idaho, and North Dakota have much larger numbers of National Guard and Reserve members serving in Iraq, wherein, in contrast, Florida, which as of May 2004 has about 4,000 National Guard and Reserve members on active duty, has only 12% serving in Iraq? The other members on active duty have been assigned less dangerous and sometimes shorter deployments, often within their home states. So why does a state of 17 million with approximately 8,000 National Guard members have so few soldiers serving in harm's way in Iraq? Could it be that Florida is vital to the 2004 election? Or is it just a coincidence and not part of a national trend? Well, upon examination of the data, it indicates that political battleground states such as Minnesota, Michigan, Arizona, New Mexico, and even California are also underrepresented for active service in harm's way. The disturbing fact is that states that are of importance to the 2004 election have fewer National Guard and Reserve troops deployed in dangerous combat zones in Iraq. In the September 1, 2004 edition of the Christian Science Monitor, Howard LaFranchi writes in his article entitled, An Elephant in the GOP Living Room, Troop Numbers in Iraq. With the National Guard now making up 40% of the U.S. forces in Iraq, Colonel Lang says many Americans are well aware of the strain. The heavy Guard involvement means all this is reaching directly into little communities all across the country, and he says it has a very important political impact. This is not only unfair to smaller, less politically important states, but it also increases the danger for all of the troops in Iraq. There are numerous trained military police companies in the battleground states serving stateside or in places such as Germany and Kosovo. In the meantime, units such as Vermont's 86th Field Artillery Unit that was trained for only 1 month to become military police have suffered severe and unfair losses in Iraq. But the Republicans have already conceded Vermont to the Democrats in the upcoming election. And Idaho is safe ground for the Republicans. As William Bendix used to say, what a revolting development this has turned out to be. And this brings us to the last deception. Paul Krugman of the New York Times, September 21st, 2004. It's Ayed Alawi Week. President Bush started with his address at the United Nations and will try to present Mr. Alawi, a former Ba'athist who the BBC reports was chosen as prime minister because he was equally mistrusted by everyone. He, as you know, is the leader of a sovereign nation on the path to democracy. We call it Iraq. If the media play along, Mr. Bush may be able to keep the Iraq disaster under wraps for a few more weeks until the election is behind us. And it may work. In June, when the United States formally transferred sovereignty to Mr. Alawi's government, the media acted as if this empty gesture marked the end of the war, even though American casualties continued to rise. Stories about Iraq dropped off the evening news and the front pages, and this gave the public the impression that things were improving and helped Mr. Bush to recover in the polls. Now, Mr. Bush hopes that by pretending that Mr. Alawi is a real leader of a real government, he can conceal the fact that he has led America into a major strategic defeat. Now, that's a very stark and bleak statement, but it's a view shared by almost all independent military and intelligence experts. Put it this way, it's hard to identify any major urban area outside of Kurdistan where the United States and its allies exercise effective control. The insurgents operate freely and openly, even in the heart of Baghdad. While coalition forces, however, many battles they win, rule only whatever ground they happen to be standing on, and efforts to put an Iraqi face on the occupation are self-defeating. As the example of Mr. Alawi shows, any leader who is too closely associated with America becomes tainted in the eyes of the Iraqi public. Mr. Bush's insistence that he is nonetheless pleased with the progress in Iraq, when his own national intelligence estimate echoes the grim views of independent experts, would be funny if the reality weren't so grim. Unfortunately, this is no joke, and to the delight of Al-Qaeda, America's overstretched armed forces are gradually getting chewed up in a losing struggle in an urban guerrilla war. So what's the answer? Well, the Bush administration fostered the Iraq insurgency by botching the essential tasks of enlisting allies, rebuilding infrastructure, training and equipping local security forces, and preparing for elections. It's understandable, then, that John Kerry, whose speech yesterday was deadly accurate in his description of Mr. Bush's mistakes, proposes going back and doing the job right. But I hope that Mr. Kerry won't allow himself to be trapped into trying to fulfill these neocon fantasies. If there ever was a chance to turn Iraq into a pro-American beacon of democracy, that chance has now perished, and it perished long ago. Well, so much for Iraq. You know, it was a war that was probably ill-conceived. Most Americans believe that, at least they believe it now. We'll have to wait and watch and see how it turns out, won't we? Stand by. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. The Veterans Administration is in the news. The VA buys drugs cheaply, and many veterans benefit. Since the VA gets the best prices on medicines, the Bush administration is being urged to adopt a VA-style program for Medicare. America's best discount drugstore is run by the federal government. The Department of Veterans Affairs throws the weight of federal buying power and a law mandating discounts on medicine into price negotiations with drug manufacturers. "We are the big gorilla," said George T. Patterson. He's the executive director and chief operating officer of the VA Office of Acquisition and Materiel Management. "We get the drop-dead best prices in the world," he said. The VA drug benefit is a life preserver for veterans like Vernon Chapin, 76. He's a retired plumber and Army veteran from Lutherville. Chapin pays a total of $56 a month for 8 prescriptions to keep his blood pressure, diabetes, and other health woes in check. Other veterans who have service-related illnesses or injuries get free medicine for those ailments. "Now, I shudder to think what would happen to me without the VA," Chapin said. "I'd be making a choice between eating and taking my drugs." Now, the VA's muscular approach to drug purchasing is the envy of private employers and insurers struggling with rocketing prescription prices and are the highest in the world. The VA, by contrast, pays roughly half of the U.S. retail pharmacy prices. The VA volume buying power, the agency negotiates for itself, the Department of Defense, the Public Health Service, and the Coast Guard. And it's a model for Maryland and other states forming multi-state pools to leverage better drug prices for Medicaid recipients and state employees. It's also the model favored by congressional Democrats and consumer advocates for the massive new Medicare drug program. A group of Senate Democrats, including Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, called on the Department of Health and Human Services last week to adopt a VA-style program for Medicare. The Medicare benefit crafted by Republicans and signed into law by President Bush last year bars the department from using Medicare's 41 million beneficiaries to leverage lower prices from drug companies. The law instead turns to private companies to cut deals with manufacturers. The benefit, which starts in 2006, carries a $530 billion price tag for its first decade. Rather than using the purchasing power of Medicare's 41 million beneficiaries, this new law fragments the population, diluting the ability to negotiate lower prices, and the senators who wrote Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson, this is not only a waste of limited taxpayer resources, it is also a cruel betrayal of Medicare beneficiaries who are struggling with astronomically high drug bills. The administration opposed efforts to give Medicare negotiating power akin to the VA's for fear that its huge volume would become a national price control and deprive pharmaceutical companies of cash needed for drug research and development. The VA represents a much smaller buying pool. While there are 24.5 million veterans, only 6.1 million of them were treated at VA medical centers last year, with 4.5 million getting prescriptions. The VA filled about 200 prescriptions last year, spending about $3 billion on drugs, up from $750 million in 1991. Now, some worry that the VA's successful drug program is in danger of being swamped by growing numbers of veterans seeking refuge from rising prices of medication elsewhere. Tens of thousands of veterans who face spiraling co-payments and premiums in their private health care plans are lining up for the VA drug benefit. If enough are allowed to tap the benefit, as they are promised, when they join the military, then some fear they could sink VA's shaky overall health care budget. Hey, I got to pause here for a second and make an observation. Have you noticed the emphasis on drugs in our society over the past, 20 years or so? Well, let's think about it. You got 24 million veterans, of which 4 million, about 1 in 6, is on drugs. Then we have our 40 million plus Medicare beneficiaries, most of whom are on drugs. Then we have 20% of our school-age children are on Ritalin. They're on drugs. Now, don't you think that America is becoming a nation of drug addicts? Is a civilization a nation or an empire that becomes addicted to drugs slated for continued dominance, or is this the slippery slope to oblivion? I cannot imagine a nation of drug addicts being the world's number one preeminent military, economic, and social power, can you? When you put 20% of your school-age children on drugs, Ritalin, doesn't that send you a signal that something's wrong? Shouldn't we be asking, why do these children need Ritalin? 50 years ago, they didn't. Somebody's going to say, 50 years ago, we didn't have Ritalin. Well, and obviously, 50 years ago, we didn't need Ritalin, did we? So what caused the need for the Ritalin, for which the Ritalin was discovered, invented, and then marketed? Don't you think that we would be better served if we found out what causes this hyperactivity? Has anybody ever thought of looking at the drug sugar? If you'll take a look at our obesity, 27% of us are now obese. We've doubled the consumption of soda pop over the past 20 years and coincidentally doubled the number of diabetics. Doesn't that send anybody a signal? What seemed like to me that the cause of the hyperactivity is the drug sugar, and that we ought to control that drug sugar, which would eliminate the hyperactivity, which then would eliminate the need for Ritalin, wouldn't it? And instead of using drugs to make us feel better, wouldn't we be better served as a nation? And for that matter, as just individuals, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. Wouldn't we be better served if we looked for the cause of the malady and then eliminated it? For instance, if the doubling of the consumption of soda pop doubled the number of diabetics, well, are we smart enough to work that in reverse and say, gosh, if we could cut the consumption of soda pop in half, could we then cut the number of diabetics in half? For which then we wouldn't need the insulin, for which then we wouldn't need the drug companies to produce the insulin, which then would be a gigantic savings just in the cost of the drug insulin, wouldn't it? Can you imagine what might happen if we were to take a look at, oh, such things as heart attack and stroke and cancer and all of these other maladies and diseases, and then work backwards, think outside the box? I know this is a wild new concept for most of you. Well, after all, if you got a pain, you go to the doctor and he gives you a drug and it makes the pain go away, but it doesn't change the cause of the pain, does it? I mean, it's all right with me. I don't care if you want to go out and drink twice as much soda pop, develop diabetes, and then go to the drug companies and get insulin. But what I'm opposed to is you coming to me and telling me that you want me to pay my taxes to buy your drugs because you're not smart enough to take care of your own body. I'm not opposed to people that want to go down and buy crack cocaine. That's your choice in life. But hey, listen, boys and girls, if you're going to outlaw Joe Sixpack going down and buying crack cocaine on the corner, why is it that you want to legalize insulin out of the local Rexall store and then send George Gordon the bill for it? It reminds me of the AIDS folks. You know, these AIDS people belong to a group called ACT UP. and they want the government to spend billions of dollars in research to find a cure for AIDS. I don't want to find a cure for AIDS. You see, AIDS is the penalty that you pay for sodomy. That's where reality is. I don't want to get in the way of God and punishment, crime and punishment. But I don't want to pay to find a cure for AIDS. If the people who have AIDS, if the people who want to break the law that say that says thou shalt not commit adultery, want to go out and find a cure for the penalty for it, that's between them and the pharmaceutical companies. Just leave George Gordon out of the equation. That's my objection. That's why over the years I came to the conclusion that I'd probably be better off if I just dropped out of this tax system and let you people go your way and I'll go mine. Now down in Florida, the Florida Appellate Court ruled that the media can legally lie to you in the newspaper, on the television, or over the radio. I thought that was an unusual news article. On February the 14th, a Florida appeals court ruled that there is absolutely nothing illegal about lying, concealing, or distorting information by the major press organizations. And the court thereby reversed the $425,000 jury verdict in favor of journalist Jane Acker, who charged that she was pressured by Fox television management and lawyers to air what she knew and documented to be false information. The ruling basically declares that it is technically not against any law, rule, or regulation to deliberately lie or distort the news on a television broadcast. On August the 18th, 2000, the six-person jury was unanimous in its conclusion that Acker was indeed fired for threatening to report the station's pressure to broadcast what jurors decided was a false, distorted, or slanted story about the widespread use of growth hormone in dairy cows. The court did not dispute the heart of Acker's claim, which was that Fox pressured her to broadcast a false story to protect the broadcaster from having to defend the truth in court, as well as suffer the ire of irate advertisers. Fox argued from the beginning, and failed on three separate occasions in front of three different judges, to have the case tossed out on the grounds that there is no hard, fast, and written rule against deliberate distortion of the news. The attorneys for Fox, owned by media baron Rupert Murdoch, argued the First Amendment gives broadcasters the right to lie or deliberately distort news reports on the public airways. In its six-page written decision, the Court of Appeals held that the Federal Communications Commission position against news distortion is only a policy, not a promulgated law, rule, or regulation. So Fox aired a report after the ruling saying that it was totally vindicated by the verdict. Well, I guess they were. That was kind of news to me, but it fits right in with what we in the underground press have been advocating or been telling you for years and years, and that is that Dan Rather, CBS, Tom Brokaw, and NBC, Peter Jennings and ABC, along with Fox and everybody else, lies to us consistently and continually. They have an agenda. They have a purpose. They have a reason. And they get paid a lot of money for doing it. If there's a news story that needs to be aired, If it runs against public policy, against the New World Order, the Committee of 300, they don't air it. If, on the other hand, there's a story and we have to stretch the truth or we have to lie about Iraq or whatever it takes to get you people to believe whatever we want you to believe so that we can get you to vote for or to follow after whatever policy that we're advocating, well, then we'll do that. So now you have the Florida Appellate Court rules that the media can lie legally. Well, of course, if there's no law against lying to people over the public airwaves, well, then I guess they can lie, can't they? And that's all that the Florida Court of Appeals is telling you, so don't get mad at the judges. I mean, the judges called it correctly. Fox News lied in their story. And as a result of that, the reporter sued Fox for firing her, and she said, well, we should be telling the truth. Now, if we were looking at the scriptures, if we were looking at you shall not bear false witness, well, then I guess that would be correct, but we're not practicing the scripture. We have divorced God, the Bible, and morality from our society. We've thrown the Bible out of public school. You don't hear President Bush or any political candidate citing from Moses, do you? So as a result of that, the people of America have accepted this phony baloney argument of separation of church and state. That's a lie. Church and state were never separated by our Constitution. Our founding fathers incorporated religion and morality into our public life for the first 130 or 40 years of our existence. It wasn't until 1947 that this concept of separation of church and state was first aired, and by 1962 it had become established. So in 15 years, from 47 to 62, is when this concept has been sold to us, from 1787 to 1947. That wasn't the law in the United States. And in the Dallas school system, in 1947, they were still teaching directly out of the Gospel of John in the Bible in the public schools of Dallas, Texas. Now, of course, they don't do that anymore. Now, just take a look at society from 1950 until today and ask yourself, is this what you want? Because if this is what you want, you have arrived. Now, the news media lie to you regularly, and you believe it. And these lies impact upon you. They impact upon you. When you follow the advice that's given to you by these lying news reporters and news organizations like CBS and ABC, it has an effect. Now, the most recent effort to keep Ralph Nader off of the presidential ballot came in the crucial state of Florida on Wednesday when Circuit Judge P. Kevin Davey issued an order that removes Nader's name from the state's November ballot, including ballots already being sent to overseas military. Lawyers for the Florida Democratic Party, which fought to boot Mr. Nader, told Judge Davey on Wednesday that more ballots were going out every second that passed without enforcement of his order. Now, Judge Davey ruled last week that the Reform Party, which has nationally endorsed Nader's bid for the presidency, isn't a legitimate party, at least under Florida state law. And he ordered counties that have already mailed absentee ballots to send out Nader-less versions. Democrats argue that the Reform Party didn't follow state election laws requiring minor party candidates to qualify by petition or through a nominating convention. Mr. Nader was nominated during a Reform Party conference call, and Reform officials say that was followed by a convention where the nomination was formalized. It was Peter Camejo, Nader's current running mate, however, who summed up correctly the motives behind the Democrats' efforts to deny Nader ballot access when he accepted Nader's invitation. The effort to deny Nader a place on the ballot is only one example of a fundamental attack on democracy. It is, in effect, saying that the public must choose among two candidates. Camejo warned, no matter how distasteful both candidates may be to them, thus it is making it impossible for the will of the people to be properly expressed, a clear case of citizen and voter disenfranchisement. Well, let's stop and analyze this for a minute. Do you mean to tell me that the American electorate is being led astray because Ralph Nader's name is not on the ballot? You see, if the American electorate were actually the sovereign power in control of their government, which it obviously is not, but if it were, then you would have about 100 million voters out here, all registered and ready to vote. And they would have informed themselves, and they would come to a conclusion, and they would say, we don't like Ralph Nader, we don't like John Kerry, and we don't like George Bush. And our candidate, and let's just call him Bill Frisk, you know, he's the Senate Majority Leader, let's just say Bill Frisk, and the majority of those voters were to write in the name Bill Frisk on their ballots. Write in. Now, I know you're saying, well, gosh, when I vote, I have to push the button on the computer. No, you don't. All you have to do is go down to your courthouse, all of you voters out there who are sovereigns and in control, and get an absentee ballot and write in the name of your candidate. And when 50 million voters write in the name Bill Frisk, he will become your next president. You see, the power of the electorate to elect anybody they want is theirs. Now, when I read an article like this, which says to me, the Democrats are working hand in glove so that they can keep Nader's name off the ballot, then evidently the electorate in Florida is not informed. They are ignorant. They don't understand the power of the electoral process. They don't know anything about absentee ballots, and so therefore they can only vote for people whose names appear on the ballot. That tells me then that the government officials, the politicians who make up these elections and these election ballots and put these names on the ballot are in control of the electorate. The electorate is not in control of the political process. The political process is in control of the electorate, which is why I've said for years, democracy is as phony as a $3 Fed note. And our Constitution and our founding fathers did not give us a democracy. They gave us a republic, which has degenerated into a democracy, and democracies then devolve into mobocracy. And that's where you're at today. People who are politically incompetent and unable to manage their political affairs register to vote, and then they vote for a leader who will tell them when to get up in the morning and when to go to bed at night and what to do in between. I'm politically competent, and I'm not registered to vote, and I'm not going to vote for any of the above. George Gordon can manage his own political affairs. I don't need Dianne Feinstein, George Bush, John Kerry, or Ralph Nader to manage my political affairs. I don't care who makes your laws in Washington. That's not a problem to me. It's the judicial power that is of importance to me, and the judicial power comes from Exodus chapter 18 and Deuteronomy chapter 1. And that's where the real power in America lies anyway. So I don't think that the Democrats are being very democratic, and I agree with the Nader forces that it's a slap in the face to your democratic process, but your democratic process doesn't work anyway. And in the final analysis, Ralph Nader is not going to be elected president, and he's going to be kept off of the ballots through politics. And I say that politics is your problem, not your solution. Now, the United States is running short of reserve troops. Did you know that? The United States military may run out of National Guard and reserve troops for the war on terrorism because of existing limits on involuntary mobilizations. Or so says a congressional watchdog agency, which warned in a report released overnight. Government Accountability Office, that is the GAO, said that the U.S. government has considered changing the policy to make members of the 1.2 million strong guard and reserve subject to repeated involuntary mobilization so long as no single mobilization exceeds 24 consecutive months. What that means is, boys, get ready to be called up for two-year rotations. In commenting on the report, the Department of Defense says that it plans to keep its current approach. And under the DOD's current implementation of the authority, reserve component members can be involuntarily mobilized more than once. But involuntary mobilizations are limited to a cumulative total of 24 months. If the DOD's implementation of the partial mobilization authority restricts the cumulative time that reserve component forces can be mobilized, then it's possible that the DOD will run out of forces. That's why they're talking about a draft. So as soon as President Bush is reelected, you can expect a draft to come into play. The Guard and Reserve are crucial to the U.S. war effort because they include specialized units such as military police, intelligence, and civil affairs that are in high demand but in short supply in the active duty areas. The Pentagon also has turned to the Guard and Reserve to ease the strain on active duty infantry divisions that have had to deploy repeatedly to Iraq. And more than 47,000 members of the Guard and Reserve were serving in Iraq as of last month, about a third of the 140,000-member U.S. force currently deployed. And when those deployed in Afghanistan and rear areas are added, the total is in excess of 66,000, according to Pentagon figures. And since September 11, 2003, more than 335,000 Guard and Reserves have been involuntarily mobilized for active duty, 234,000 from the Army alone. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on a compact disc, so for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.